Support for WVIA Pop Shop comes from the F.M. Kirby Center for the Performing Arts in downtown Wilkes-Barre, presenting concerts, comedy, family entertainment, and community events in a historic theater. Information and upcoming events at kirbycenter.org.
So, Patrick, the end of summer brings the end of Oak Street.
Oh, it does indeed.
Which conjures, of course, a debate I think people listening to this podcast have probably had for 10 years.
Which is?
What's your favorite dinosaur?
Are we talking actual dinosaur or pop culture dinosaur?
I brought pop culture dinosaur. Were we supposed to bring real dinosaurs?
I brought both.
Okay.
Because we didn't actually say which dinosaur, but I brought both.
Okay. So what's your favorite real dinosaur?
Stegosaurus.
Why?
I don't know. I just have always liked Stegosaurus. Okay. I actually made in like elementary school, I made like a clay Stegosaurus.
Yeah.
Which I wanted to bring, but I couldn't find him. So. But
that's
sad. His name was Steggy. I'm not great with the names.
Not your best work.
So yeah, Stegosaurus is my favorite actual dinosaur.
So in terms of pop culture, there was a bit I wanted to bring, but I couldn't commit to it.
Okay.
Obviously, my favorite pop culture dinosaur should be the Dinobots from Michael Bay's Age of Extinction.
Okay. See,
but I have to be honest with you, I don't remember a single one of them.
You don't remember Grimlock?
Nope.
Yeah. See, I do have them on my list, but the animated version. Specifically, I say in my notes, not the Michael Bay version.
So...
I do have Grimlock specifically, but yeah, the Dinobots. They were my favorite group of Transformers.
So do you have Yoshi on the list?
No. Is he a dinosaur?
I think so.
I thought he was more of a lizard.
Kara, do you know?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I am not.
You
a
give me Yoshi
dinosaur
and Delfino Square.
Person.
Oh yeah.
I've been
again every time. Mushroom Gorge is my jam.
Now,
on
Hope,
Mario
if she's
Kart.
Listening right now, she just yelled, "That's a lie," but I beat her every time.
Okay. Yes, Mushroom Gorge is my go-to if I want to win.
Yeah. You know what? You never race? Rainbow Road.
I cannot do Rainbow Road.
No, I'm just terrible. No. So my favorite all-time dinosaur pop culture, Dino from the Flintstones.
Yeah, see, that's the obvious one.
Oh, well, thank you for that.
So.
What's your non-obvious choice?
Godzilla.
Okay, fire-breathing dinosaur.
He's sort of a dinosaur.
Yeah, I kind of like Dino more. Dino's like warmer and friendlier.
I mean, when I tried to think of like cartoon dinosaurs, Dino was the only one I could come up with. So
yeah. And Kara, your favorite dinosaur?
I have none.
Kara's like,
That's not something I think about.
It is time to go to the show.
Yes, time to go to the show, where we'll talk about the end of Oak Street.
Hi, I'm Alan Austin.
And I'm Patrick Hamilton.
And welcome to Pop Shop. Hear stories on the screen, inspire conversations about the real world.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there.
That's
sorry.
Okay, we're good.
And this week we're talking about The End of Oak Street, the sci-fi film where a family finds itself transported to prehistoric times, and they and their neighborhood struggle to survive.
Not a single pun, which is a bit disappointing. But if you are enjoying this, or you have enjoyed the show in the past, or you intend to enjoy the show in the future, please make sure, as Kara always tells me to remind you, like, subscribe, and turn on the old notification machine.
That's right. And WVIA's Pop Shop is brought to you by the F.M. Kirby Center, and we'll be talking with Neil in just a little while about what they've got going on.
But before we do, Patrick, let's set up the movie. You kind of did that, but I'll try to do a little more detail. The End of Oak Street is, I think, a film that's really easy to understand if you can put yourself in the mindset of the 1980s and dinosaurs. That we have a family that's struggling and on hard times. The father, Greg, has lost his job, and he's coping by essentially some light to moderate day drinking and working as a pizza delivery boy. I think that's true, though, Kara. Kara's looking at me like that's not true, but I do feel like that is kind of where he's at.
It's fair in terms of what goes on in the film.
Denise, the mother, is dreadfully unhappy with her life in suburbia. She wants to move to New York City and probably abandon her family so that she can become the novelist that she imagines that she is. The kids, Brian and Audrey, are kind of living all of the troubles that 1980s kids and teens did. They're fleeing neighborhood bullies. They're both on the cusp of different kinds of sexual awakenings, the kinds of things that you would expect, again, in a 1980s film. If that's not enough, though, the family finds themselves and their neighborhood transported in ways I can't describe at present through time and space to a prehistoric world where dinosaurs are king and have a real taste for human flesh. Can the family pull itself back together? Can they write a better future? That is the story which this film then pursues.
Yes, and so starring in the film are Ewan McGregor as Greg Platt and Anne Hathaway as Denise Platt. They're sort of headlining the film. You've also got their two children, Audrey, played by Maisie Stella, and Brian, played by Christian Convery. The film, of course, is written and directed by David Robert Mitchell and produced by good old J.J. Abrams of Bad Robot and Lost and any number of sci-fi sort of mystery puzzle films.
It's a sad point in your life when you become good old whatever.
Mm.
You know, good old Patrick Hamilton. You feel like you've lost like a step along the way.
No, I didn't feel that way until just now. So thanks for that.
Hey, doing what I can.
Feeling good about myself. I'm identifying with Denise right now in the film.
Ready to flee to New York, reach your true potential.
Exactly. That the people around me are just holding me back from.
It's a bumpy start today. But you know, it's what's never bumpy with you is talking about the 1980s. I don't know anybody who loves the 1980s quite as much as you do.
I love certain aspects of the 1980s. Let's not pretend that the 1980s were, you know, a great time for all. But that particularly on the level of like 80s pop culture, I do love 80s television, 80s music, 80s movies. Like that's where a lot of my love of the 80s comes
from. And I think
from.
Definitely not trying to paint you into a corner. When I watched this film when it was done, I thought, this is a film that I think you would enjoy on that level.
Mm-hmm.
This film is just suffused in the 1980s. Like, it has a deep 80s vibe to it.
It does, though it didn't have, except for, I think there's one shot of the Simon game on the nightstand. And I guess the posters in the kids' rooms and stuff like that. In terms of, like, the sets, I didn't quite have the 80s stuff in your face. But there were elements like the outdoor neighborhood barbecue.
The block party that everybody was
which we used to do, particularly on July
4th. Like an 80s block party?
Yeah.
You know what they say, ain't no party.
Like an 80s block party?
100%.
There you go. So, you know, the kids wandering around aimlessly, you know, one of them armed with a makeshift bow and arrow.
That's totally normal.
You know, the kind of stuff that went on in the 80s. So in that sense, it did have those sort of 80s vibes.
Well, for me, it opens with Pat Benatar's Hit Me With Your Best Shot.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the music,
like,
true.
Any movie that leads with Pat Benatar, and like that's the best Benatar era, I think, is kind of like pulling me in. What I liked about this movie in suffused, the way it was suffused in the 80s, was that it wasn't, like, you see sometimes it'll be, like, so obvious in your face that you use, like, Reagan Bush 84 signs in the yard or whatever. Yeah. Here it was about when a weird plant grows in your yard, nobody can just pull a phone out of their pocket. Like, they have to go
to the library.
To the library to do research, and they have to look up information about dinosaurs in the encyclopedia set, which probably to, like, the younger generation today is... It's like you and I grew up with Model Ts or whatever.
Yeah,
like
pretty much. Like,
and so also the media, the way media was delivered, how cool a Walkman was back in the 1980s.
Oh, Walkman was tip-top technology.
When kids wanted to watch TV.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you now talk to college students about TV, and they're like, what's TV? Right. Yeah. And so, you know, like, there's Playboy magazines floating around in here. It's just, like, such a... To me, what I loved that I thought Abrams really captured here was kind of an homage to the feel of the 80s.
Yeah.
Without making it so in your face.
Yeah, I would agree.
Like, that you felt like somebody was shoving the 1980s at you.
Yeah, I mean.
It was all the small stuff that made me. And then the film itself feels like an homage.
Oh, yeah.
To a 1980s family-based action-adventure
film. Kind of like your Steven Spielberg's or action-adventure films or things like Gremlins. I think that the creators have said it's very intentionally kind of based on those films.
It's interesting that you mentioned Spielberg because there's one scene in particular. One thing that Spielberg was really well known for, obviously, in the 80s were those chase scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one scene where Greg is being chased by a dinosaur, but they're separated by a wooden fence that you can't see through.
Yes.
And we see only Greg running in front of the fence.
Mm-hmm.
The dinosaur we never actually see.
I think you see a little bit of
maybe
it above
like
the bush.
Like his head might...
Or its tail or something like that.
But you see the dinosaur's progress because it's knocking over clotheslines or it's knocking over swing sets or upsetting people's picnic tables.
Yep.
And I thought that was maybe not as good as quintessential Spielberg, but an homage to the kind of film that Spielberg was making in the 1980s.
Yeah.
That again just was another level of sort of the 80s feel. It felt like And I don't like the 80s probably as much as you do.
Oh, not there's no probably about it.
But the film felt almost like a warm cocoon of the 1980s to me.
At times. And then there are some moments of violence that go well beyond what you would expect in kind of the 1980s. In the 1980s, I imagine this film probably would have been rated R.
Yeah.
As opposed to, well, and being set in 1982, it's set before the PG-13 rating came out.
Yeah.
And yeah, there are some moments of very jarring violence that kind of take you a little bit out of that kind of 80s sort of environment a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting to think about that kind of juxtaposition, mm-hmm. and how the culture has coarsened maybe a little bit over time, that the violence we've become so much more accustomed to,
mm-hmm.
back in the 80s, even in the 80s, people would have said that's a little bit too much.
Yeah. I think also it works for me. It worked on a level of kind of resisting the nostalgic idealization of the 80s.
Yes.
That, you know, it you know, we do kind of get a very kind of nostalgia-filled idealization of kind of the 80s neighborhood. I think one of my favorite scenes was when, you know, the parents are running from the dinosaur, and then there's the other family across the street that are just getting into their car, completely oblivious of what's going on. And kind of the way in which that you don't really, in the 80s, again, because we didn't have, you know, Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and things like that.
Yeah.
You didn't really know everything that was going on around you in the lives of your neighbors. And that was a moment that it kind of caught that for me.
Well, yeah. Also, in that way, I think Abrams is really playing with this tension of how we want to remember the suburb, mm-hmm. and maybe what the suburb really was,
mm-hmm.
right? Was the suburb this place of safety,
mm-hmm.
or was it a place of danger?
Yeah.
Was the suburb a place of morality, or was it a place of corruption?
Mm-hmm.
And in many ways, you get that block party at the beginning is quintessential sort of Americana,
mm-hmm.
you know, God and apple pie America.
Yeah.
And then very quickly, we see maybe the suburb is less united than we imagined it to be, and maybe mm-hmm. more dangerous than we also
imagined. even in the sense of the family at the center, the Platts at the center of the film are not nearly as united as they seem to be at the beginning of the block party.
Right. And I think that's a theme, like this theme of togetherness and whether it's real or mm-hmm. not is something we can pursue in the second half of the show when we've got
more room for spoilers.
Yeah. There's so much to say.
There's a lot to say.
Without spoiling some of the basic mm-hmm. premises, it's hard.
Yeah.
So it was interesting to me how well I thought the 80s vibe carried this film for me.
Mm.
That it pulled me along, maybe not all the way to the finish.
Yeah.
But for quite a while, I thought it worked pretty effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And not like an overt appeal to nostalgia.
Yeah.
But like a quiet appeal to nostalgia in a way that made you feel like you were going back to something that doesn't exist quite anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to call it a period piece because that makes me feel really old in terms of talking about an 80s film as a
period piece.
But it is kind of a period piece, and that it does kind of capture...
That is not the official position of the show.
If you set aside the dinosaurs, it does kind of capture... Yeah, I try not to think of the 80s in terms of a period piece, but sadly, I think we are at the point where the 80s sort of are a period piece, which raises a question I wanted to ask you. So kind of thinking about this in comparison to Stranger Things, which do you sort of does a better job, like better, enjoy more in terms of capturing the 80s?
I think this did a better job. Like the comparison to me was Stranger Things, which by season two in particular was so beating people over the head with it
mm-hmm.
that it felt too much to me. I prefer this. I think Abrams does a really brilliant job of evoking the 80s without yelling in your face, I'm evoking the 80s.
Yeah.
And by the way, the favorite sentence that you've ever said on a podcast to me mm-hmm. is, the dinosaurs aside.
Yes. Well, we won't be setting the dinosaurs aside as we move into the next part of the show after we get done talking with Neil from the Kirby Center. And once again, we're joined by Neil from the Kirby Center to talk to us about all the things they've got going on there.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Love the show. I'm excited. I haven't seen this movie yet, so I'm really curious to see what happens. The end of Oak Street. Oh, man.
Despite the low box office in the first week, it's worth watching, for sure.
Hey, that's very good to hear. That's the thing, though. I'd love to hear that more than anything else. So, like, good. That means there's good in front of us, right? People can still make really cool things.
Absolutely.
Yep. That's awesome. And speaking
of... can make cool things that aren't based on some other property.
Right.
Nice original storyline, too, so.
Who would have thought of, like, dinosaurs in movies?
Yeah, I know. It's
example.
Crazy.
It's like a real...
Dinosaurs running at the and attacking people?
Like, yeah, like dinosaurs and humans in the same place.
Never like, seen before.
Crazy good idea.
I'm surprised someone finally came up with it.
Yeah. It's this long, right?
Exactly.
Feels like it's been since the Jurassic era that we've had something like that.
Actually, it's funny.
We've been parked in neutral.
Well, I mean, we probably talked about it before, but this past spring we had the Philharmonic in, and they did a live play along to Jurassic Park, and it was amazing right on the Kirby stage.
Oh, yeah.
Because that orchestra literally stretches to the edges of the stage, so they're packed as tight as you can get. But then you hear the big symphony that is the Jurassic Park score from John Williams. It is beautiful.
What a great idea.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And so we love those kind of presentations, but coming up with the Kirby, though, this fall, holy moly. You know, we're towards the end of August right now, which means you get a little quieter at the Kirby, but the reality is we're really gearing up everything for the fall. And we're excited because then this September, we have great acts like Ray LaMontagne is coming in, celebrating his 20th anniversary with a Trouble album. If you're not into that music as well, don't worry. Kirby's got you covered. You're on Pop Shop. You're watching this right now. So you're like, where's my movies? And so we've got The Godfather coming up, which Godfather, believe it or not, fun fact for those listening to the podcast, The Godfather was the longest running movie at the Kirby back when it was just a movie theater in its own, when it was a Paramount back in the 70s. The Godfather was the most successful film they ever had. It literally ran for weeks on end of sold out showings. So imagine like 1,800 people in a theater consistently, week after week, coming to see a movie, which is absolutely amazing.
Yeah. We should do The Godfather on this podcast.
I would have to see it.
For the first time, I am aware.
I'll tell you, you guys know somebody. I might be able to take you in.
Don't give me Godfather 2.
You don't like Godfather?
What a great thing.
Godfather 3 is the one that people don't like. You don't like Godfather 2?
Godfather 2 is overrated.
I have so many questions. We'll talk about this off air.
100% new.
Yeah, poor Kara. She's sitting there going, even Kara probably agrees with me. She's like, no. Godfather 2 is good. Kara's the best.
I like how you got Kara on camera. Well done.
Oh, well, we're always going to try. I mean, Kara is the best. People need to know more.
Absolutely.
Kara, what do you think about the Kirby?
I love the Kirby.
Hey.
I'm excited for Gary Owen, who's coming in, I believe, November.
Yeah.
Have a seat, ready to go.
I love it. Great. Again, amazing comedians. Comedians love to play the Kirby. They always have a great time. Why? Because there's not really a bad seat. And also, because it's an old theater, you can literally stand on stage unmiked and someone could hear you in the back of the theater. It's a fun party trick, actually. But you can sit there and just talk to someone normally from the other side of the room. But with the actual sound system, the amplification, it's just an amazing place to see a show. And so I recommend anyone who's looking for a great show in northeastern Pennsylvania, in Wilkes-Barre, in the heart of downtown, you can go to kirbycenter.org and find out about all the great shows and events we have coming up. We're constantly announcing new ones. I mean, again, this will come out on a different day, but we just announced the Almond Betts Family Revival, which is an amazing show in December. Really excited. Anyone who's been down with the Peach Festival years ago would love this show. So, again, find out about all the great shows at kirbycenter.org.
All right.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you guys for having me. I love the show.
Thanks so much, Neil. Great to have you here.
That's right. And now we're moving into the second part of our discussion of the end of Oak Street. So, fair warning, all kinds of spoilers are ahead.
There's no way to avoid the spoilers, I don't think,
Patrick,
at this point. So we were both interested in talking about sort of the moral and ethical implications of a film that seems to have none.
Yeah.
On some level, right? It's an action adventure. Mm-hmm. It's kind of grounded in that 80s vibe.
Yeah.
It should have no ethical implications at all. And yet they are written all over
the
film.
There are ways that you can kind of enjoy the film on that level.
100%.
But then this is what Pop Shop does, is we go deeper into kind of the meaning and ideas within the film.
Some people call it deeper and some people call it overthinking.
It works either way.
Yeah. So can I ask you an ethical question to begin with that has to do with time travel?
Yes.
Now, you may know I have a lot of problems with time travel.
You do.
I sometimes struggle to understand the mechanics of it. But here's what I understand.
Mm-hmm.
So the family of four.
Yes.
We'll call them the Prime family.
Mm-hmm.
They get sent into the past.
Yes.
But three of them escape.
Yes.
So Denise Prime and Brian Prime and Audrey Prime all manage to get back to the present.
Yes.
And when they do, they climb this hill. So they're outside. They come back to the present, but it's like 30 minutes before this terrible disaster is going to happen.
Yeah, they don't come back at the moment they left. They come back about 30 minutes before they were zapped into the past.
Before this wormhole magically zaps them into the past.
As they do.
Yes. Apparently. So they climb the hill to get out of they're in the safe zone now. And they order a pizza to lure Greg away. And then the disaster happens.
Yes.
So they have essentially taken Greg 2, we'll call him, because Greg Prime has met a very, very grisly demise in the land of the dinosaurs.
Greg Prime does not make it in a very violent way.
I have to say, in a really startling way. When that when that came on the screen, I actually sat up.
Yeah, I mean,
it was not expected.
They do foreshadow it pretty heavily at one point, but even then, I was not expecting that.
I think the manner in which Greg Prime goes out will be a classic scene for a long time.
Yeah. Yes. But so anyways, back to your ethical dilemma.
Yes. So, sorry, I'm distracted. So they have essentially kidnapped Greg too, or convinced Greg, they've saved Greg too, but they've sacrificed Audrey too, and Brian too, and Denise too.
Yes.
They've now condemned them to go to Dinosaur Land.
Yes.
Without Greg to help them survive.
Yes.
In Dinosaur Land.
Yes.
That seems like a fraught kind of decision
to make.
Well,
you can push it further, because at the end of the movie, we find out that they called the librarian.
Right.
And convinced her to leave. They called the annoying neighbor.
The guy they all hate.
And saved his life.
Right.
But those are the only ones we see. Like, none of the kids' friends, beyond the Jeanette that comes with them, and she apparently saves her family.
Right.
Like, they condemn their entire neighborhood, except for the few select people that they could call.
They have this godlike power in deciding who's going to survive the dinopocalypse.
Well,
and who's not.
If you want to defend them, they only have about 20 minutes.
And
they've
got to
call these people. Point. And convince them, which is going to take some time.
Right, and they're at a payphone, so they could have run out of change.
Yeah.
One supposes.
So, but there is kind of an issue of like, oh, so a certain number of people do survive.
Yeah.
And a much larger number of people, don't.
The worst part of it is, Greg doesn't seem to care that Denise, too, and Audrey, too, and Brian, too, have been sacrificed. They're all living super happily 2 years in the future.
Yes.
In the epilogue, where she's written a bestseller, and they're living in a fancy house, and I'm thinking, these people are terrible people.
Yeah.
I've been rooting for them to get back together for the entire film,
mm-hmm.
and they're terrible people.
I have a different sort of ethical dilemma with the end of the film that you just talked about.
Okay. So, but do you agree
that
the way that the film wants us to see it as a happy ending feels a little problematic.
On that level and another level, yes.
Unless Abrams is overthinking it. And the point is that in America, we destroy ourselves all the time for momentary happiness in the present. Do you think that's the metaphorical meaning that Abrams is trying to impose upon us?
I don't think so. I think if I were going that route,
I think you're probably right.
One way to read to the end of the film is that everything's fine once she's really successful and they have money.
Yes. The big house.
The big house. Right? And yeah, so... So, yeah, so there is kind of that was the direction I thought you were going in, is that, like, they do condemn a whole bunch of people, like the bully that was bullying the son, but also the bully's brother that didn't want him to do it. They're gone. Like, all the neighbors are gone.
A neighborhood full of people they were hanging out with at a party, acting like they were all best friends.
Yeah. The other problem with the film, because you alluded...
Well, other is limiting a number of problems, but go on.
Sorry. Yes. Another problem with the ethics of the film. Yeah. Is because you mentioned at the beginning of the film that Denise and Greg are having problems in their marriage.
Yes.
That, you know, Greg, as we find out, you know, lost his job. He's having to work. He's keeping that secret because of sort of like the shame he feels.
Yeah.
You know, taking delivery jobs on the side.
Yeah.
Denise, as you mentioned, is you know, wanting a greater life, wanting to abandon her family.
She's fantasizing.
And the problem is that at the end, in terms of how that gets resolved.
Yeah.
It's only Denise that has to change. That she, though, kind of looking at her arc in the film, the entire arc of her character is getting her to value her family in a way that she kind of doesn't at the beginning of the film.
Right.
Because Greg is, because we switch Greg Prime with Greg 2.
Yes.
And Greg 2 doesn't go through the experience of going back on time, back in time.
Yeah.
He has learned nothing. He is unchanged from the problematic Greg at the beginning of the film. Right. Greg doesn't have to change.
No.
Only Denise has to change. And there's kind of the sense of, Denise in, you know, wanting to abandon her family, wanting to pursue this writer career that she doesn't feel she can do. She has to keep it secret, writing in the basement and whatnot.
Yeah.
That's the problem in the film.
Right. So that Denise can only have economic success, you're saying, after she accepts that she needs to write about her family one assumes her Dinosaur Land book, because she's now a best-selling author.
Yeah.
Like, she has achieved her dream.
Yeah.
But she hasn't really achieved her dream on her terms.
It's somebody else's
story that she's now telling, in a way.
And also, in the sense of the problems that the family was facing, they all end up being resolved because of how Denise changes, which makes Denise the problem.
Well, yes. Whereas it's also about money.
Yeah.
Right. Once they have money, Greg's not a problem anymore. He can just be a lazy-about guy, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm not really sure I'm not sure what Greg is doing.
And why would any of us kind of celebrate Greg?
Probably not delivering pizzas anymore. But yeah,
oh, there's no way he's delivering pizzas.
The way in which that kind of at the end of the film, Denise becomes, she's the only one that has to change.
Yeah.
And it almost kind of sets her up as the source of the problems in the beginning, which I would argue are perhaps equally.
Oh, for sure.
Particularly amongst the parents.
At a minimum. I think there's a bigger problem.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of expands beyond the family in that way. And that is, like, there's the theme of the film is kind of about togetherness.
Yes.
The film is set up in a very 80s kind of way mm-hmm. where it's meant to be. The family is falling apart, but we're going to watch them kind of come back together, remember that they love each other and accomplish great things in their life
mm-hmm.
as a result of having done that. But it's also making that argument about the 80s. At the mm-hmm. block party, the entire community is in it together.
Yeah.
As soon as the wormhole hits, it is every man for himself.
Except maybe
every family for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, I think Denise says, you know, smart people would pool their resources. Like, we'd all get together and we'd save food and we'd save guns.
Yes.
Nobody does that. The only person that joins the Platt family mm-hmm. is Jeanette. And that's by accident. Like, they don't go out to seek to help her. They're not trying to build a community. She just kind of stumbles into their lives.
Well, in defense, Jeanette, she stumbles into the kids. And the kids, when they find her alone and that they realize that her family is dead, the kids do sort of accept her in.
Right. But it's accidental, right? Like, they're not trying to build community. Community kind of stumbles along the path to them.
Yeah.
And so there's this immense contrast between America when times are good
mm-hmm.
with the block party and the barbecue and everybody's eating and drinking and we're all friends.
Mm-hmm.
And as soon as the hard times hit, that community is shown to be completely false. It's not real. It doesn't exist at all.
Which is one of the ways, and I think people have talked about this, you can kind of see the film talking about our present moment in what is doing in the past. And that there are ways in which that you can see sort of, you know, when they face sort of what one might call a pandemic of dinosaurs, they kind of each go into their silos and kind of fragment. And there's ways in which that you could look at the COVID pandemic and see that American society of today did something similar.
But also suggesting that maybe the 80s America that we remember is this like united country as part of a Cold War was more fractured than we actually like to remember it,
mm-hmm.
you know, that this is like an indictment of this fake sense of American community or really the suburbs in some ways.
Yeah.
Although then the ending where the money makes everything happy.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Like it may be, maybe that we're reading a bit more into this film than the makers intended people to read into.
To be fair, it is very 80s that money makes everything better. It does sort of fit the 80s vibe.
I think it's very quaint that you think that that's an 80s vibe.
We've totally
conquered that.
I'm not saying we've conquered, but it is something, you know, the era that produced movies like Wall Street and Greed is Good.
Yeah.
You know, it seems like that is an appropriate kind of ending.
But Wall Street was critiquing it, right?
It was, but a lot of people learned the wrong lesson from it.
Yeah. But you know what you never learned the wrong lesson from?
Us.
The Pop Shop.
That's right.
Because now it's time to take...
Yes.
I was going to say a complicated piece of pop culture, but maybe not so much this one.
It's deceptively complicated.
There we go. And give it a simple rating.
Yes.
And I think we haven't let Kara get on camera hardly at all today. So, Kara, like, how do you feel about the film?
You know I did not see it, so this was not necessary. Hello. That's all you need from me today.
Did you not see it because you didn't want to see it or you were just too busy?
I want to see it.
Okay.
I just cannot keep up with this cadence of seeing it, you know, the first weekend it comes out.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Tell me about it. Apparently, I have to watch Lanterns for next week.
Yes. So. Don't. Then we're going to tease that later.
Sorry.
Don't have to go to the theater to see
Fair
it.
Point.
So you're good.
Fair point. All right. So I gave it a pop. Why not? With a little shrug emoji.
Oh, is that with the shrug?
Yeah.
Okay.
But it's got a smile on his face.
Okay.
My sense of it is... It was a fun movie.
Mm.
It's not high art, but it's not intending to be high art. It can get you thinking about bigger issues if you want to. Mm. If not, you can just immerse yourself in what felt like the warm 1980s until you realize it wasn't so warm. But why not?
Yeah. For much of the same reasons.
Yes.
I gave it a pop minus. Not wanting to invent yet another iteration of our pop versus shop system.
I'm running out of system.
Again, the puff, why not, with a shrug. You just keep adding things on there. But for that, because, you know, it can be enjoyed on just a purely kind of popcorn, fun, you know, dinosaurs running amok. Though I will warn people, the giant snake dinosaur, you know, freaked me out, and I'm still having nightmares about that.
Yeah.
But then the problems that we have with the end of the film that we sort of talked about kind of just knock it down a little bit for me, and the way the film comes together in the end kind of introduces problems that I don't think the creators necessarily intended and may not have been aware of.
Right. And yet there they are. And we would not be doing our job.
That's right.
As pop shoppers.
Correct.
If we weren't pointing out these kinds of really profound ethical and moral lapses that nobody really intended.
And potentially overthinking the Dinosaurs Eat People movie.
There's a chance. And yet, who's to say?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I think that wraps things up for this week on the
Pop
Shop.
Yes, it does. Yes. So thank you for joining us on WVIA's Pop Shop. And if you're enjoying the show or any aspect of the show, we'd love it if you would subscribe. Turn on notifications, and there's something else that I'm forgetting that we asked them to do.
Like it.
Oh, like the episode. That's what it was. I know there was third, and I totally forgot what it was. Yes, like the episode as well.
Yeah. And thanks, as always, to our friends at the Kirby Center as well for their continued support.
Yes. And next week, as Alan already alluded to, we will be talking about the first couple of episodes of HBO's Lantern series, another spinoff from the DC Comics universe. Will it be a brightest day or darkest night for this latest installation of the DC movie universe?
Come join the party.
Wow.
Wow. That
way to sell it, Alan.
Yeah, way to really get people to come see the episode.
Support for WVIA Pop Shop comes from the FM Kirby Center for the Performing Arts in downtown Wilkes-Barre, presenting concerts, comedy, family entertainment, and community events in a historic theater. Information and upcoming events at kirbycenter.org.